Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney, although Frank will be along a little later with a special interview with our friend Congressman Louie Gohmert. But we're going to start the program today talking about a cover-up. And no, it's not the one that you think. You don't have to go all the way to Benghazi to hear about this cover-up. This involves CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, an organization that we keep our eye on. But they are currently embroiled in a lawsuit that involves our friend and colleague, David Yerushalmi at the American Freedom Law Center. And David, thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about Saeed versus CARE and Lopez versus CARE, which are the two suits that you are representing the plaintiffs in.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, these are cases that arose out of a fraud that took place at CARE's Herndon, Virginia office back in 2006, 2007, and 2008. They had hired a man by the name of Moores Days to be their resident attorney and civil rights manager, and the lawsuit arose because we discovered that this Mr. Days was not an attorney, and he had been representing CARE clients for years, supposedly, and filing lawsuits, taking care of all kinds of immigration matters. Well, it turns out that he wasn't, and he didn't. And in March of 2008, enough CARE clients were outraged over his inability to respond to any of their inquiries or to show proof that he was actually representing them, went out and got other attorneys, came and threatened to sue CARE National. When CARE National got that information, they required Herndon office to fire the man. A month later, they find out he's not even an attorney. They finally did their due diligence. But in the meantime, with dozens, and I mean dozens of CARE clients calling in and trying to figure out what's going on with their cases or complaining, all CARE did was simply bury the problem. Having fired Days, they took all the legal files to Washington. They closed down the Herndon office. They told all of the CARE clients, oh, he was an independent contractor. He's no longer here. You can, you know, reach out and contact him on your own, even though they knew he wasn't an attorney. And beyond that, those who actually went out and got a lawyer, those CARE victims, and who came and threatened to sue, CARE would go ahead and settle with them. They'd pay whatever they had to pay, and they would make the CARE victim sign a settlement agreement that said, you will not mention this publicly to anyone, or we can sue you for $25,000. What were they doing? They were using essentially an extortionist club to make certain that this wouldn't get out so that the other dozens of victims would not find out.
Is that illegal, David, to do something like that?
Well, their conduct, CARE's conduct in terms of the cover-up and the settlements is illegal on so many fronts, it's hard to know where to begin. The fact is they were liable for Moores Days, even if they didn't know anything, because he was acting as an employee attorney for them, so they have what's called respondeat superior liability. An employer is responsible for the bad acts of its employees. It's done in the course of their job, and this was. But beyond that, because they covered it up and claimed he was an independent contractor when they knew he was an employee, and by forcing these settlements, which was essentially their effort to literally force people to be silent. And remember, CARE National was these people's law firm. An attorney cannot go to a client that attorney is screwed and say, you know, look, I'll pay you what I have to pay, but you have to keep your mouth shut. They have a duty. CARE had a duty not only to tell this person, you have the right to sue us, and they had a duty to reach out to every CARE victim affirmatively and explain to them, we screwed up. We hired this bad guy. We'll pay our dues. But as Nixon found out, the cover-up is always worse than the crime.
But let me ask you something about the victims themselves. CARE obviously portrays itself as an advocate for Muslims in America. Clearly, some of these victims were Muslims, were they not?
Yeah, in fact, most of them were. Five of our clients consist of, we have five plaintiffs in this case. We have three African-Americans, two of whom are Muslim. We have a third Pakistani-American Muslim, and we have another client who is a African-American woman seeking a divorce. So we have a range of clients, but the majority of whom, four out of five, are Muslim.
Well, setting aside the legal outcome, of course, which you're waiting on right now, I would think the public relations outcome is already pretty severe for CARE if this gets publicized, because here they are portraying themselves as the leading advocate for Muslims in America, and they're actually defrauding. Criminal fraud is involved here. People they're supposedly advocating for. Clearly, that's got to have some impact on the credibility of the organization.
That's right. And that's why, you know, in cases like this, it's an interesting phenomenon. In cases like this, you oftentimes will enter into a confidentiality agreement, and the court will issue it as an order saying, look, if a party, either side, designates documents or testimony as confidential and private, then that information will be put under seal, and no one in the public can see it unless the court opens up the records. But normally, you have to be very careful that what you're designating as confidential or private is, in fact, that. If you abuse that, you're engaging in the cover-up once again. Well, guess what CARE did? Every document they produced, it didn't matter if it was a blank piece of paper or, you know, a tax return that's, you know, part of the public domain, they designated every piece of paper and every bit of testimony as confidential. It had to be filed under seal. Our motion, we have several pending now, that's what we filed on Friday, is to asking the court, you have enough facts before you to say that CARE is liable for fraud, breach of fiduciary duty, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. And all we have left to try are the damages. We have an additional motion that says, Your Honor, CARE has abused this court's order by designating everything confidential so that every piece of paper had to be filed under seal. We want every bit of that stuff, other than someone's social security number or medical record, to be open to the public. And we believe the court will grant that motion.
Now, just to be perfectly clear, these two suits, these companion suits, are against the National Office of CARE, even though this actually took place in the Virginia chapter in Herndon, which is now closed, right? But the charges are leveled against the National Office because it was that office that didn't do the due diligence and actually defrauded these victims. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. Because, look, Morris Days was their employee. They said it. CARE Virginia was their agent chapter office. They were doing CARE National's business out there. And more importantly, after the fraud was discovered, CARE National took the legal files of our clients and then attempted to cover up.
Where did this guy Morris Day come from? I mean, if he wasn't a lawyer, did he to some degree hoodwink CARE into thinking that he was? What's the story on him?
Well, you know, he hung out at the Adams Center over there in the D.C. area, the famous or infamous Adams Center, and held himself out as an attorney. And the head of CARE's National Office for Operations, Khalid Iqbal, who also happened to be the executive director of the CARE Virginia, Herndon, Virginia office, and who also happened to work at the Adams Center, knew Morris Days for many years, and brought him on board.
So it sounds like a kind of cronyism that got this guy originally involved without any due diligence whatsoever.
Yeah, I asked Khalid Iqbal under oath in deposition testimony, well, Mr. Iqbal, what due diligence could you do before you hired Morris Days? You know, in this day and age, you can Google someone and find out in a second if he's a little. And his answer was, and I'm quoting now, none. And I said, none? He said, no, none.
All right. Let me ask you this. When do you expect a decision on this, David? Are we nearing the end of this entire proceeding?
We are. I mean, we've been at this since 2008. So we've been this has been a long, hard-fought battle against CARE, which has engaged big law firms to defend themselves and in-house counsel. We believe that the court is likely to rule within 6 months. And then the question is how many euros after the one for damages we're going to wrap back up.
But you're reasonably confident it will go in your favor, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are cases where you think, okay, well, this could go either way. This is just not one of them.
Okay. Well, David, good luck with this. Keep us posted on this. And thanks for exposing CARE for who they truly are.
You, Fred.
You bet.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, the adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying they're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're joined by the Honorable, and I mean literally, the Honorable Louis Gohmert. He is a United States Congressman representing the 1st District of Texas. He is currently serving as the Vice Chairman of the Subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee, responsible for terrorism, homeland security, and crime, and a critical moment in time for us to be talking with him because Congressman Gohmert understands better than just about anybody on Capitol Hill, by my lights, the nature of the threats that we're facing from these Islamists who are much in the news these days, notably in Egypt. Congressman Gohmert, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always great to have you, especially in a moment like this.
Well, it's always good to talk to you, Frank, and I sure appreciate your work.
Well, thank you, sir. Let's visit with me for a minute, if you would, about this latest ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, brokered by the Muslim Brotherhood president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi. There was a time last week when this seemed to be, all the rage, that some great act of statesmanship had been achieved by Mr. Morsi. How do you see it? Did he really stave off something terrible, or has he simply postponed it, perhaps for his own domestic and international reasons?
Well, let's look at what resulted. The agreement has not resulted in a stoppage of weapons going into the Gaza Strip. It's not resulted in a complete cessation of violence by the Islamist extremists in the Gaza Strip. It's, in fact, the main thing it's done is give Morsi such great accolades from the Obama administration and Secretary Clinton that he then had the temerity to step up and without using the word Pharaoh, basically demand that he was now completely in charge. I mean, as if he were Pharaoh. And you said the words all the rage, and it reminds me, what was all the rage a year and a half ago? It was the Arab Spring and how wonderful it was, and this administration really embraced throwing out Mubarak. Yes, do it by all means. Getting rid of Gaddafi, it wasn't enough to send verbal accolades. This administration sent planes and bombs and support to oust Gaddafi so that al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood could take over Libya. Some of us were fussing about it back then, but we faced what was then, quote, all the rage, unquote, and that was, you know, Muslim Brotherhood taking over, and call it Arab Spring, call it Arab Winter, whatever you want to, but it was disastrous unless you were wanting a new Ottoman Empire to take place, and that's what this administration helped jumpstart. So with that same kind of spirit and enthusiasm and excitement that we saw from this administration as al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood took over in Libya, and has now taken over in Egypt. Now we're seeing that for the Morsi brokered temporary peace. There is not going to be any peace in the Middle East until the Palestinians, and Newt Gingrich is right, that's a relatively new term. They certainly weren't around 3,000 years ago when King David was ruling from Hebron and then for 7 years and then Jerusalem. But they were in this land 3,000 years ago, and people, including the Palestinians, need to recognize their right to exist as a Jewish state, as everyone did in the UN in the late 40s. And now what we've seen instead is just a growing anti-Semitism, this hatred growing toward the Jewish people. I never would have dreamed we'd see this kind of thing in not only Europe as we have, so shocking again, but seeing it spring up even in the U.S.
Yeah. Our guest again is Congressman Louis Gohmert. He represents the 1st District of Texas. He comes to this role of a 4-term member of Congress by virtue of having spent time on the bench in his native state of Texas, both as a district judge, 3 terms elected to that post, and serving as the Chief Justice, appointed by Governor Rick Perry in the 12th Court of Appeals in Texas. Congressman Gohmert, you've captured, I think, the mood very well here. We were told at the time of the so-called Arab Spring that we were on the wrong side of history backing people like Hosni Mubarak. I wonder whether you would argue at the moment that given the consolidation of power that the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi is engaged in now, given particularly how it fits into the real transformation of the region into an increasingly Islamist-dominated well, you call it a new Ottoman Empire, but whatever it is, it is a region awash with people deeply hostile, not just to Israel, but to us as well. Whether we are finding ourselves squarely on the wrong side of history by backing, as the Obama administration has done, the Brotherhood and its friends.
Well, yeah, and I'm not concerned about the area being controlled by Islamists, except that they happen to be radical Islamists. And we could see that. You know, so many of us back even in Libya back a year and a half ago when the Arab so-called spring started, I call Arab winter, when it first started, this administration said, we're sending in planes, we're going to help out. And some of us are going, look, we know absolute certainty that there are Al-Qaeda members involved in this revolution. So we better wait to see who we're helping before we keep helping. And this administration didn't care. It was so overwhelmed with joy to see the Arab Spring that we turned it into a world winner, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Congressman Gohmert, let me just ask you quickly, because you were one of five members of the House of Representatives. Newt Gingrich called you all the National Security Five, who back in June of this year wrote letters to inspectors general of five different departments, raising the question that some of these dismal policies that have resulted in the Obama administration embracing Islamists at home as well as abroad, and finding itself, I would argue, squarely on the wrong side of history as far as freedom is concerned, may be a function of these Muslim Brotherhood associated individuals who are serving in or advising the Obama administration. Looking at what's happening now, looking at what has developed since you wrote those letters, do you feel that that issue should be raised anew and much more aggressively as Congress looks into the fiasco in Benghazi and now more recently in Egypt?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it almost makes a prima facie case when you look at the decisions made by this administration over the last couple of years, or actually all 4 years, but you look at the decisions it's made, especially in the last 2 years, and going through the revolutions in Northern Africa and across the Middle East and to the Far East. And the only way you could explain the horrendous decisions that were so completely wrong-headed would be if this administration had a bunch of Muslim Brotherhood members giving them advice. But, I mean, even in Egypt and with the 9/11 protests and in Libya and across the Middle East when there were rebellions and people chanting death to America and we're all bin Laden and burning President Obama in effigy, the only way people in this administration could make the incredibly foolish pronouncement that, gee, it's not that they dislike America or it's not that they dislike this president. They just dislike the video. The only stupid or moronic would be if they had Muslim Brotherhood members advising them, oh, no, don't just disregard all the people saying death to America. They really love you. They love America. It's just a video. How else can you explain the moronic nature of this administration's responses?
Yeah, a great question, and I hope that it will be put by you and other members of Congress to administration witnesses and, frankly, to all of us, the press. It just raises questions that demand answers, and I appreciate you being there, Congressman Louis Gohmert, to ask them. Keep up the good work and come back to us again soon.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Today's security environment for executives, elected officials, and dignitaries has changed dramatically. To address new security challenges, you need the veteran-owned private security firm, Independent Security Advisors. The team at ISA has over 20 years of experience in providing dignitary and executive protection. ISA's network of licensed security providers are global and available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Independent Security Advisors has partnered with the University of Maryland Police Academy to provide one of the most respected dignitary protection training programs in the country. ISA custom training programs will fit within your budget and are designed to meet your organization's specific requirements. Take advantage of ISA's other services, such as security consulting, electronic surveillance detection and mitigation, or private and secure travel services. Contact Independent Security Advisors at info@dignitaryprotection.us or visit their website at dignitaryprotection.us. That's dignitaryprotection.us.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. UN Ambassador Susan Rice meets today with three senators who said they would block her expected nomination to become the next Secretary of State. The legislators are upset by her central role in misleading voters about the murderous jihadist attack in Benghazi on September 11th. Ambassador Rice excuses her conduct, claiming she was just repeating erroneous talking points supplied by the intelligence community. And congressional investigators still can't tell who deleted the fact that al-Qaeda-related groups were believed responsible and who put in the fraudulent narrative that the attack stemmed from a riot over some video. What we do know is that Susan Rice is an architect of the Obama policy of engaging, enriching, and empowering Islamists who are our enemies. That's reason enough to keep her from becoming Secretary of State. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at SecureFreedomRadio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement? And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy, again in for Frank Gaffney today, and always glad to talk to Neil Monroe of the Daily Caller, who is keeping a close eye on Mohamed Morsi's power grab in Egypt. And Neil, thanks for being with us. Obviously, the story is the president, the duly elected Democratic president of Egypt, has pretty much told the judiciary they can take a hike. As you cover this, what do you suppose is his motivation?
Okay, delighted to be here. The Islamists are a patient bunch. They want to build a theocracy, but they're, weirdly enough, they're modern people. They're engineers and doctors and accountants. And many of the leaders have been to universities. And so they're a weird combination of primitive Islamic fundamentalism and modern organizing. Morsi himself was a lecturer in USC. And what they're after is building a Islamic apartheid-like theocracy where Islamic clerics and men, same thing, rule over women, Christians, Jews, and foreigners in general. But they're willing to do it slowly. And to some extent, I mean, the brother has been around more or less in the 20s. They're following the example of a comparable Turkish group of Islamists who took power and gently, carefully, cautiously move to win control over the army, the police, the schools, the media and business in order to build power. In that sense, they're really, in a way, Arab is Muslim versions of progressives.
So in a way, they're following a model that is closer to Recep Erdogan in Turkey than, for example, the Islamic takeover by Khomeini in Iran, which was abrupt. Obviously misunderstood by the Carter administration, but what you're saying is Morsi seems to be following a little subtler model in terms of consolidating power. Do I read you correctly?
Yeah, you know, yes. We're kind of used to ideas of coups where the military grabs the radio station and there's some generals on steps announcing that everyone will wear their underwear outside their pants or whatever. No, these guys are much more modern and sophisticated, and they move over time. And because what they're trying to do, forgive the phrase, is build heaven on earth. They're progressives. They believe that they know best how to guide people's lives. And in that sense, they are more dangerous than the crude old people waving guns or sabers in the air.
Well, then let me ask you, because obviously your article in the Daily Caller talks about how the White House has been more than a little circumspect on this. I saw a clip of a press conference with Jay Carney yesterday, and it all came down to semantics. He was concerned but not critical. Why is the White House being so circumspect on this, do you suppose?
We don't really know. There's some things we know and some things we don't. So we know they're being very cautious and careful. And this comes after more than 2-3 years of efforts by the White House to remove Mubarak, help the Brotherhood gain power. And I mean help the Brotherhood. They, right from the beginning, they pointed to the Brotherhood as a potential new political party. Hillary in June said, when she met with Morsi for the first time, she was telling the military to stay out of politics and leave a free run for the Brotherhood. She said, you know, we accept civilian rule with all that entails. They're flashing green signals all over the place that they're okay with the Brotherhood taking over. Now, it is not clear if the Obama and his deputies really understand what the Brotherhood is. Maybe they think that the Brotherhood is just, you know, a bunch of people like them who go to university and talk a lot about religion but don't mean a word about it. From the way American progressives talk, American progressives say nice thing about religion, they don't believe a word of it. And in that sense, it's entirely possible the American progressives simply don't understand the religious basis of their Egyptian peers in the Brotherhood group.
Well, then it seems to me, if that theory is correct, the Egyptians, and for that matter the Muslim Brotherhood, wherever they happen to be located, understand us a lot better than they understand them. And that leads to my next question, because there is a lot of commentary about Morsi's actions to some degree were emboldened by Hillary Clinton complimenting him on the Israel-Hamas ceasefire. How instrumental was he to that, and is that a way of saying that the Muslim Brotherhood now clearly is in control of Hamas?
Well, now we arrive at President Barack Hussein Obama's desk. President Obama invited Morsi to participate in this effort to impose a ceasefire on the Israeli counterattack. He invited him in. It wasn't necessary for him to invite Morsi to get involved with this. And the president could have said to the Israelis, finish the job, humiliate the Islamists, and maybe they'll be a little bit more cautious about trying to grab power. But no, the president called Morsi about 6 times over a couple of days and then sent Hillary over to Egypt to sort of sign an imposed ceasefire, which gave Egypt a lot more influence in Gaza than they ever had before. And even then, Morsi refused to meet in public with Hillary Clinton. And the next day, Morsi turns around and crowns himself dictator like Napoleon. And it really may be that the president, well, we seem to know with the good evidence, the president is running his new beginning Arab outreach policy by himself out of his office with a few trusted people right from the beginning. This effort was run by the president, not by the State Department, not by a circle of advisors, but by him. Now that he has put so much on the line and has watched the Brotherhood win the elections, win the presidency narrowly, win the parliamentary elections overwhelmingly, the presidency narrowly, he seems to be, in effect, trying to help the Brotherhood in order to justify his previous policy of overthrowing Mubarak. It's strange. It kind of looks as if the president is now deliberately ignoring what the Brotherhood is because he didn't look before and it's too late to go back.
Well, let me pursue that a little bit, because there is a coalition emerging calling themselves the National Salvation Front, made up of liberal and secular groups, many of them socialist in nature, but a lot of them obviously opposed to this kind of totalitarian gesture by Morsi. Do they constitute a real opposition to the Islamist government, or is this, in your view, just a flash in the pan? And to what extent would the United States support their efforts if they're trying to institute a real democracy in Egypt?
Okay. The real political power lies in Egypt by the military, but the military has been very quiet for the last couple of years, in part because the U.S. government, Obama, has sort of pushed and prodded them to stay out of politics. Secondly, there's the Brotherhood has about half the seats in Parliament. A quarter of the seats in Parliament are held by an even more bunch of radical firebrand Islamists who go around shrieking that we should all act like Muhammad's helpers from 1,400 years ago. Then there's the judges, who have their own prerogatives, and then there's a tiny rump of Western business, free market, lefty, secular people who range from conservatives like Americans who are small government business to lefties, but they don't have much power. Some of those parties didn't even win any seats in the parliamentary election, and yes, in the presidential race, Morsi won with only 52%. Everyone else sort of allied against him to support a old guard Mubarak crony. And so Mubarak is not that strong. If the president wanted, he could drop hints in public that he really, if the Brotherhood wants to go for a grab for power, they're going to do it without American cash or European cash. And because basically Egypt can't feed itself. If without foreign aid, either from the West or from Saudi Arabia or Iran, they have a massive collapse of their society and starvation. So Morsi doesn't really have much of a choice. If Obama jerks his chain, he's got to back down. There is no sign that the president is really pressuring Morsi to back down from his power grab. It's kind of weird. The president intervened when Mubarak was around, but he's doing squat when Morsi is making a fool of Obama by grabbing all power.
Yeah, it sounds from what you've described, Neil, that really Morsi is the jerk-or and Barack Obama is the jerky. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
We'll find out in the next couple of weeks, though.
All right, well, good. We'll talk to you then. Neil Monroe from the Daily Caller. Thanks, Neil. And we'll be right back with Andy McCarthy.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express Travel Service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen to
the Gospel. I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Secure Freedom Radio, Fred Grandy in for Frank Gaffney, and always a pleasure to talk to our friend and colleague, Andrew McCarthy, who is writing about the ceasefire in his recent piece in National Review Online. And Andy, as always, a great piece of writing, but I'm curious because I've seen a lot of commentary about the quality of this ceasefire, and I want to put a question to you that has been raised by some of your fellow pundits, and that is, who are the winners and the losers in this ceasefire? Because I'm not sure what you're saying is exactly what the chattering class is really agreeing with.
No, I think that's right, Fred. I mean, the big winners are Hamas and Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president of Egypt. And I think Israel is an enormous loser because the fact of the matter is that until Israel is allowed to win, we will continue to in this cycle where every few months, a couple of years, Hamas gears up and does something like this again, or Hezbollah does, or they both do at the same time. In a war of this kind, which is really existential as far as Israel is concerned. You either win or you lose. A holding pattern doesn't help Israel. It just allows the bad guys time to grab a breath and rearm.
Well, I did read a piece by Dennis Ross, who you know for years was one of our most prominent Middle East envoys, essentially saying that Israel did get something out of this because they reestablished the deterrent. In other words, they kept Hamas from firing rockets into southern Israel. But of course, the point you make is we've now got a situation where apparently, according to the Court of World Opinion, targeting terrorist leaders is a greater offense to humanity than targeting innocent civilians, which is what obviously Hamas was doing, whereas Israel was trying to take out their leaders. That doesn't seem like much of a victory to me or much of a deterrent.
No, I have respect for Ross. I do think he's never seen a negotiation he didn't like. From my perspective, negotiation in this instance puts Israel on an equal plane with an international terrorist organization, which to me is just dumbfounding. And if you look at what the terms of the ceasefire are, they impose additional obligations on Israel, such as standing down on the blockade, which has been a big goal of Hamas for a long time, because it's can easily get weapons in that way if Israel doesn't by the sea lanes, if Israel does not maintain that blockade. So I just think to have a situation where the way this has been orchestrated, Israel's on an equal footing with a terrorist organization, and Israel just wants to live in peace, whereas Hamas will be satisfied with nothing less than the destruction, the elimination of Israel, and the global community seems to be fine with that, is certainly not something that's to Israel's benefit, and it doesn't speak well of negotiated settlement.
Well, it also, it sounds as though you and I are on the same page with this conclusion as well. One of the dividends for Hamas, clearly, is that they are almost considered to be a de facto state now. They've been raised to a level of legitimacy that almost makes them a country, whereas, as we continue to call them, they're a terrorist organization, a foreign terrorist organization, so designated by the United States State Department, but nonetheless completely legitimated in this process.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and it's not just by the government. I was astounded to read the accounts in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times where the Prime Minister of Egypt went to tour the Palestinian territories, particularly the Gaza, to show support for Hamas. And what they report in the papers that he met with a major Hamas chieftain who they regarded, or they described in the articles, as the Prime Minister of Gaza. Now, this guy is a major international terrorist, and we're supposed to believe, I guess, by the alchemy of Islamic democracy, that he comes out of a referendum, which puts Hamas, a terrorist organization, in charge of Gaza, and suddenly he's a statesman. He's the Prime Minister of Gaza, instead of what he actually is, which is an international terrorist.
Are you talking about Ismail Haniyeh?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Right.
All right. So this guy is essentially the Jerry Adams of Palestine now, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
although even worse, I think, because Hamas, I think Adams was trying to sort of bulldoze his way to the negotiation table, which, of course, he succeeded in doing, again, showing terrorists that their methods work. This guy's being legitimized as a political figure and a statesman.
All right. Well, let me talk about another big winner, because it occurs to me that almost as big a winner in this entire scenario is Mohamed Morsi. And I say that because really the United States turned to Egypt to broker this deal. In the past, the United States has almost always turned either to Turkey or to the Saudis to act as honest brokers in any kind of these Middle East dust-ups. But now Egypt seems to have moved to the front of the queue.
Yeah, well, that's because, as we've been trying to point out to people for a number of years, it's not that Hamas works with the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood. And in this instance, Obama has spent all the time since the Egyptian uprising of early 2011 legitimating and empowering the Muslim Brotherhood, so that when we got to this impasse and when Israel was poised to do the ground invasion that it can't win without doing, they decided to turn to the guy who Hamas essentially answers to in the order of things, which is Morsi. So you not only have the effect of legitimating Hamas, you further empower the Muslim Brotherhood. And we saw the wages of that within about 24 hours of Obama and Obama administration officials praising Morsi. He went out and declared basically dictatorial powers unto himself.
Yeah, I can't say much for his timing, but that's a story that remains to be written. One other loser that you don't talk about in your piece, Andy, but I wanted to get your impression. It seems to me that at least a tangential loser in all of this is Mahmoud Abbas. I mean, where does Fatah figure in now in terms of the future of the Palestinian state? It seems that he is at best a silent partner and maybe a non-entity.
Yeah, you're right. They've been marginalized. But, you know, Fred, I think he's been marginalized, interestingly, you know, the same way Israel's interests have been depressed in this whole thing, and that is that by recognizing Hamas, you implicitly legitimize their brutal methods. And it was by brutally evicting the Palestinian Authority under Abbas from Gaza that Hamas had the position that it has in the first place. By embracing Hamas in this process, you're necessarily saying, you know, all is forgiven for what was really a savage operation that put Hamas in charge of Gaza in the first place. Now, part of me sort of says, you know, good riddance to Abbas, because they're moderates only if you consider them against an outfit like Hamas or Al-Qaeda. You know, these are moderates that maintain their own armed terrorist wing. So I never have thought much of them as moderates or potential negotiating partners in the first instance. But it is interesting that the international community, as they like to call it, has basically blinked its eyes at Hamas's methods and welcomed them to the table as a legitimate actor.
All right. Well, finally, where do you think this all shakes out? Look into your crystal ball. How long do you think the ceasefire lasts, and what are Israel's next steps, do you suppose?
Well, I think Israel obviously is consumed for the next few weeks, at least, with their domestic politics, and I would expect that Netanyahu will be reelected, although what kind of coalition he'll have remains to be seen. I believe that the Muslim Brotherhood and its partners in the enterprise of destroying Israel have been playing an inside-outside game for years. Within a course of 6 to 18 months, you'll have more saber rattling. I don't think the missiles will ever really completely stop firing. That's the outside part of the extortion. And the inside part is to try to pressure them to make political commitments that will make Israel essentially indefensible. So, it's going to be very tough for Israel in the coming years, not only because the strategy has shown to be working, not only because Hamas has basically succeeded in internationalizing the opposition to Israel by getting itself this legitimacy, but also because they're looking at 4 years with an Obama administration that, as American administrations go, has not been a reliable partner for as far as Israel's security is concerned.
And doesn't look like it's going to be much of a friend in the future. Andy, we're going to have to leave it there. As always, a great piece in National Review Online. Thanks for being with us. That'll do it for Secure Freedom Radio for this evening. Frank will be back tomorrow. Fred Grandy saying, until then, stay safe.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.